All right, Guillermo Mascio, I'm at the Electric Plant, the Electric Plant studio down here in Gasoline Alley. And I'm here with Dale Price and Josh Garcia, who are going to do their own introductions.
My name is Dale. We work on the second floor.
Well, short and sweet. I mean,
yeah, there you go.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I like that. Tease my horn already?
No. And I'm Josh, and me and Dale collecting this awesome facility for us to start making records up here.
So why don't you tell our listeners a bit about what makes Dale and Josh tick?
Well, I've been recording in Chico since, you know, the 80s. I started my business in 88. I really got going with recording when the digital tape recorders came out in the early 90s. And been recording bands just throughout my whole existence here in Chico. And had a studio up in the canyon for about 14 years, and that's where I met Josh. Josh is friends with a bunch of bands that I've worked with, and he came up to produce the Vesuvians, and he really liked the space, and I really liked the way he worked, and I could tell he was a great audio engineer. And so at some point Josh wanted to come up and do some tracking, and I told him I was going to move, and so we started looking for a place to record in Chico, and we looked at a few different rooms and talked to a few people. And I've always really liked what Electric Energy Plant was doing, and a big fan of those guys. And so we reached out to them and hammered out a deal where all three of us could work here, the original Electric Plant guys, Energy Plant guys, and Josh and myself.
What about you, Josh?
As far as me, I say I'm going on 15 plus years of audio stuff and learned the hard way and turning around and that kind of thing. When I, like I said, came up here to produce a record, and I found Dale's place, and I was totally blown away. I was, mm-hmm. It was unfortunate enough to work in a lot of world-class studios and where I got brought up. And when I walked into Dale's place, it was right on par with all the stuff that I worked in LA and San Francisco. And it was awesome. And it was in the canyon. It was just a really cool setting. So I immediately, you know, me and Dale immediately kind of, as the band was saying, we're just nerding out about acoustics and just all the engineering aspects of it. And mm-hmm. I love this place up here. And I work back and forth in San Francisco and here. And when I was looking for a place to work out of, you know, Dale was the first person I hit up to see if what he knew, what was going on, because I knew he'd been here for decades.
And I knew Josh was cool because I blew up his tweeters during the session, and he was totally cool about it. He made no big deal. He had a momentary moment, and it was like, back to work. Yeah. Okay, no tweeters.
We'll get by.
But it's funny, we've actually worked with a lot of similar bands, me in the 90s, because Josh works, does a lot of stuff for punk rock labels like Fat. And when I was on the Warped Tour in the 90s, turned out I worked for a lot of the same bands as a live engineer that that he has recorded and worked with and stuff. So we both have our fingers in the you know, the punk rock world. That's West Coast punk rock scene.
It's pretty funny.
How does it feel to be down in Chico with a studio? I know you were up in the hills for so long.
It's bittersweet. A lot of the artists are bittersweet about it too. One thing they enjoy is that they don't have to drive an hour round trip to do a quick overdub. And the nature of how people work is different than when I built the studio. I mean, not only is gas more expensive, there's more wildfires. That kind of worry, there's some stories there. But the fact that people can just kind of pop in, check a mix, it lends itself to more collaboration. That's why Himp was in here. He just came in to do a quick voiceover for me. Boom, you just pop over. So it's a little of both. I mean, I really like being out there, but I also like the fact that we're in a collaboration type space where we can all share equipment, ideas, the space, because one guy having a, you know, I had 1,100 square feet there. Here, I think we have 1,300. About 80% of the time, you're working in the control room editing, and the rest of the time, you're using the full studio. So one guy doesn't need the full studio all the time. And then we can both benefit from sharing the gear and the knowledge and the clients is too. I'm getting too damn busy to cover each other.
That was kind of fun for me because as we're setting up all my little bit of gear to do this interview, you guys are just like back and forth, you know, talking about the different things in the studio and how to do this and that. And it was kind of cool.
I'm all about just having the artist be comfortable, you know, and just that's the, my most important thing, because I've never gotten a good take out of uncomfortable, well, not never, but rarely gotten a good take out of an uncomfortable artist, you know, and so it's really important to me, and this place is totally doing it.
I'm the same. Yeah, you, people got to feel like they're comfortable and they're engaged.
That way they're not thinking about what's happening. They're just thinking about what they're creating. You know, that's a huge thing for me.
Why don't we start with you, Josh, with this next question about giving us a little, just a bit more insights into your individual and joint careers.
You know, all the way back when is, you know, I started interning and realizing that this is, you know, this is what I wanted to do is record bands. And, you know, I had, there was schools available, but not available to me at the time. So I learned it the old way. Basically, was I was told by other engineers that, well, get an internship, make some coffee, and maybe, you know, eventually make a record kind of thing. And so I started, and I, you know, a good one was at the plant in Sausalito. And that was my first internship. And I got fired from there, actually, because I ruined a mud vein session. So I was kind of happy about that at the same time.
You started at the top.
Started at the top and ended at the bottom. And that was a, you know, was a good summer, though. It taught me a lot about kind of what I was getting myself into. Mm-hmm. And then I quickly learned that I didn't want to do it that way. And so I found another studio called Hyde Street Studios. And I started interning there. And that was a lot more my scene. And there was a lot more collaboration, like, you know, Dale mentioned the collaboration about that, and that's also something that kind of I gel with too. And was intern and staff engineer, and I just kind of got a lot of experience doing that thing, you know, and then just kind of bounced around throughout California for a few years engineering, and then I started doing live sound and touring all over the world. I had a couple of bands take me all over the world, a few laps, which was amazing time, you know, and then kind of got burnt out of that a little bit, you know, and then started running a studio in San Francisco. And I've been doing that pretty much for the last 5 years or so, and going back and forth. I have my daughter in San Francisco in the studio there, and a lot of my friends are clients and bands and stuff that we play with, and starting to, you know, come up here.
What about you, Dale Price?
Just let me say for the record that losing or screwing up an artist session is no laughing matter, but if it happened a while ago, it's kind of funny.
It happened a while ago.
Time has passed.
And to my defense, I did go all over Sausalito to get 7 individual cups of coffee, and I got them there hot, and they were mad that I interrupted the session, which I didn't do.
You have to own your mistakes, though. If you screw something up, you got to tell them right away. I know. No, you are. I'm just saying in general.
Like, I may have moved a mic on a drum set once, but... Just kidding.
Yeah, I started doing audio, messing around with tape recorders. My dad had a reel-to-reel when I was 4. And so actually one of the first words I said was tape recorder. I learned to thread it. Sometimes the tape would be upside down. I'd record Speed Racer and it would come out backwards. So I was enamored with music from a young age. Did the school band thing. I started doing sound for a school fundraiser. That was a really big deal. It's still one of the biggest fundraising organizations, called Chicken's Ball in San Carlos, where I grew up. And my dad got railroaded to do sound because the live sound engineer that he'd been using for a few years was kind of a jerk. I remember him yelling at me I was about 12 and I was on stage, my buddy and I, and we got kind of near a microphone, maybe a foot and a half away, and he got on his talkback, "Step away from the mic." And I was like, man, this sound guy's kind of a jerk. So I guess they had problems with him. So they forced, kind of railroaded my dad into doing it, even though he's an electrical engineer. And so I was there helping him figure it out. And then he just let me mix the show. And because we were in the Bay Area, we met with a lot of other engineers that would kind of show us how to do things, like how to ring out the PA. And so I got a taste of it pretty early, and then had been playing drums since 4th grade. And then when I came to Chico, I started playing in a lot of bands. And almost flunked out of Chico State doing a mechanical engineering degree. And at that point, I switched to music, and they were starting the recording program. And so I was actually the first graduate from Chico State with the recording option on my sheepskin, which nobody's ever even looked at my thing when you work in this field. But I still work in my field. So then I started a company with 2 other guys, servicing bands, doing live shows, and that led to doing more and more shows, and then doing some touring. I've done probably 4 or 5 national tours. Worked in a few countries abroad, and generally when I go out on the road for a while, then I just want to get back to Chico and hang out and work. So I've done some concise in 2000, when I finished the Warped Tour, I thought I'm just going to build the sound company more and start building a recording studio. And that sort of led to where I'm at now, where about 25% of what I do is still live sound and 75% is recording. And that would include recording for local bands, sometimes having regional bands come up, working with bands remotely from Nashville and LA, and doing a lot of PBS specials, some of which are recorded at the brewery, and occasionally working for TV. And I've dabbled in film a little bit, mostly doing film posts for shorts, things like that. So I have my irons in a lot of fires. Yeah, to live in a small market like this, you got to be horizontally integrated.
Right.
But
and you're doing some of the sound cuts for Sue Hillebrand's film, right?
Yeah, I'm working on American Totem for her, and then I'm starting another film I don't know much about, the punk rock soundtrack, in a couple weeks. And then I did a B grade, maybe even a C grade sound post audio, which is the mixing and doing a little bit of additional stuff, sound creation for Heidi Moore, a film called Dolly Deadly, which is actually doing pretty good. Apparently her next film's going to be backed by somebody, one of the major guys in B-rated films. So yeah, I just love anything related to audio. You know, I do a lot of ambient sound stuff on YouTube.
Oh, I love ambience. I'll have to look it up. What's your YouTube handle?
Dale Snail, DaleSnale. And yeah, a lot of noise clips that just go on for 10 hours. Ambient noise. Some of them are sonic collages, but extreme minimalism. And what we're finding is sometimes people want to listen to something, but they don't want to listen to music. Mm-hmm. And so now we have those kind of options where if you want to listen to the side of the road for 10 hours as cars drive by.
Let me swing over to you, Josh, and talk a little bit about expanding on the art and science and the human aspect of audio production.
I've always been fascinated with sound. It's just amazing to me, you know, how you can kind of mess with people using different keys and you know, different messing with different frequencies and amplitude of certain things to really get emotion out of people has always been very interesting to me. So I always try and utilize that. And I noticed when I was touring, you know, playing some of these places with 30,000 kids and people singing along with my friends playing music. And it was always fascinating to me. It's like, yeah, they played great. Obviously they got themselves there. But once I got the mix together, how much more the crowd responded. That was always an interesting fact. Like, it was always like, you know, usually in those kind of things, you don't have much time to deal with stuff. You know, the first song's always kind of like the sound check song for me, right, if you will. And you can see everybody kind of the band's getting into the groove, the crowd's getting in, I'm getting into the groove. And then once we all lock in, it was always interesting. It's like, oh, wow, the crowd's going crazy. You know, I love that.
I like a little bit of the nuances some of the major bands that use to kind of get the audiences involved. One of my favorite memories was I saw Pink Floyd in Massachusetts, and they played Wish You Were Here. I was absolutely certain they started off with a little bit of the background of somebody singing, like in the crowd. So towards the middle of it, I'm just like, I'm singing, and I'm kind of like, oh, man, they've put this, wait a minute. And I look around, everyone in the whole stadium was singing, you know, and you thought that was like pre-recorded, but no, it was actually live. You know, it was a really interesting phenomena.
Just to elaborate on that point, if you can get the audience to participate and sing along or play tambourines or clap or hold up cell phones, what you're doing is you're creating a group effect and you're actually releasing oxytocin, a feel-good drug, in the people. And so you'll see the best bands do that. And so note to Chico, you know, engage with the crowd like that, and you'll create a more of a memorable experience. But I went through the same thing when I first got a subwoofer and started bringing it into the Red and Gray pub. It was like, man, people are dancing more.
Totally.
So good sound helps with the feedback loop, what we call the positive feedback loop. Uh-huh. And the funny thing about live sound is you can just have one or two errors, and those are what people will talk about. You know, I did a show recently where the power went off, and the next day people just want to talk about the power shutting off instead of how great the headliner was. So there's a bit of that, and we all kind of consider ourselves experts as music listeners. You know, the definition of an audio engineer, my definition, is you are there to connect the artist, the messenger, with their message, with their target audience. Mm-hmm. And using the technology at hand that currently exists that you can currently afford. And that's it. And I've had people interview me for different things, you know, for maybe their class, and they're kind of dumbstruck by that. But really, that's the bottom line. And so that goes whether you're at a live show or in the recording studio, or you're making a film, or you're doing a senatorial debate. You're helping be the conduit with what's there. And if you do a really good job, it goes, for the most part, unnoticed, and maybe you get a pat on the back from a few people that know what's going on. But that's our job, to really stay out of the way, but then to have answers for all kinds of crazy things when the time comes up, you know. Sometimes
usually solutions before the answers.
Yeah, sometimes the wind, you know, like, can you make the wind change and go the other way? I mean, it's crazy what people will ask you to do. And I think that's just because they know audio engineers are solution finders. And we have to really know a lot of things that go beyond just pushing the faders, even though that seems like the glorious part. You know, I have to know how to change the fan belt on my truck and a million different things just to get to a show. And there's a lot of details, but I love that, being responsible for all those details. It's a big challenge, and somehow I've not gone insane doing it.
You know, James Chatto, who we interviewed last week for this little segments that we're doing, he had talked about, I can't get the exact words, but he had said, you know, and it's really stressful, you know, doing the live performances, because you got one take only, but he says, I kind of like it. You know, he kind of liked the whole feel he got, kind of being the guy making it happen. And we were talking specifically about the Butcher Shop. Do you have anything to add to that, Josh?
I think that's one of the things that I do love about live sound, is that it is one time. When I make a mistake recording a record or mixing something that I, you know, hopefully only I know it, but when I hear a mistake being played back over and over again, I don't like listening to the record as much. You know, I don't like listening to that particular thing, because I think it's just like, ah, I wish I did this different. I wish I did that. But live sound, when it's a great show or when you mess up, like, ah, all right, well, where's tomorrow? If you're on tour, or if it's just that one off, like, I was with Earthless. Was it last night? Or I think it was Earthless was last night, or the night before last, 2 days ago. I was mixing Earthless in San Francisco. It was a great show. You know, band played great. It sounded good, you know, and it was a lot of fun. It was just like, and I just always remember, like, oh, you know, those guys were doing a small handful of dates, and they just, I don't know. It was just, again, on that, it's over and done with before you know it.
Yeah, not all engineers can work in both disciplines, too, because sure, there's an instantaneousness to getting stuff fixed, right? That left speaker stack's off. You got to get it going now, because the show's happening. In the studio, you've got more time to sit back and get things right sonically for the all-time greatest
lunch break. We're going to figure performance.
So both of Josh and I think, are unique that we're both that type of engineer, because I'd say that's maybe 30% of engineers are recording and live sound and can work in both disciplines, because they're very different, even though a lot of the mics are the same and a lot of the concepts are the same. You need it right away. It has to work now, versus you've got a little bit of time. But that has also taught me to work really fast in the studio. So if a band's tight on funds, like a student band, we get going real quick.
That's funny. I think for me, it's like when I get into the studio, that part of it goes away. I still take forever to do stuff.
See, I pretend that Bob Dylan is coming into the studio and he's going to walk in and start singing. And you better have hit record, because he's like, that's it, boys. See you later.
Yep, see ya.
And if you didn't get it, you're fired.
A lot of times for me, is that's why I'll book another day before and after whatever the session is for me. And if I usually have the time, because then mentally I prepare it and set the studio up for the given task at hand. So I can set it up my way where I'm comfortable, and I know that I can make the artist comfortable again, but I don't have to have the band being here waiting 4 hours for me to deal with some stupid thing. And they get impatient, lose interest, and someone, you know, next thing you know, the bass player is off somewhere.
You know, Dale, you something you mentioned made me think about something really recent, this whole connecting sound to the audience, right? And how that sound is kind of visceral. It may bring back a memory, or it might be a memory that you're going to remember 10 years later. But it was the coolest thing. I was in a studio. My show's on right after Sanjay, and his last song, he had it on vinyl. It was like a $200 album. So he's telling us it was like a really rare album, but it had a whole bunch of pops, your standard vinyl pops and hiss. And it was like repetitive as the RPM. You can almost start to feel the vibe of when it was going to do this, you know, like that. But it was so fascinating to me, because when the CDs first came out, because I'm back in the reel-to-reel too, I was like, oh, I hate that hiss. I hate that. I hate that, the click and the pop. But I found myself listening to the Sanjay, that reggae, going, I like that. It kind of brought back this you know, my youth, you know, when I was throwing these vinyls on my realistic turntable.
Yeah, charm to it.
Yeah.
I was at a producer's panel at a trade convention, and these guys were talking about how the clicks and pops on your records, you know, I had a Van Halen record that skipped at this one spot every time, and a Led Zeppelin record that skipped here, and a Who record that skipped here. Those become your clicks and pops.
Yeah.
And I can sometimes listen to that. So I can listen to Baba O'Reilly on the radio, and I know when my clicks and pops are coming up. So it becomes part of your experience. And one of the amazing things about audio is it's always getting better and better. But how can the emotion be played through a 78 to really emote somebody? So there's something really amazing about the brain's ability to sort stuff out and find emotion in really crude technology. And even though we purport that we're super advanced now, we know we have a long ways to go with digital recording. And some people say our recordings today might even be similar to a Simpsons cartoon as far as the clarity and detail. You know, we do a lot of tricks to make things sound amazing and supernatural, sometimes beyond reality with the sound stage, or we try to make it very real, but to what degree it's actually real, we don't know, but definitely whatever you record, if the mic positioning, the mic, everything does not have to be perfect. If that artist brings it, that's the take, you know? And so that's why even the first take, a lot of times I haven't got everything perfectly ironed out, but if they're like, that's the one, great. I'm not going to make them do another one if that was the moment. You know, if somebody feels inspired, I just hand them a microphone and hit record and try to really be in the moment and capture that moment that the artist is feeling.
Another thing I'll add is actually a live recording broadcast I did yesterday with Ali Battaglia and Mandolin May, and she was tuning her uke. And I said, I just miss the day when, you know, musicians would play a little bit out of tune. You know, you were hearing those notes a little bit different than the musician next to you or before you, but now it's all so rigid. And they both kind of really perked up. Like Allie was, oh yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's just like everything's got to be, you know, exactly. You got to get your little electronic note. You know, and it's like you had said, Dale, it's all about the sound and how it makes you feel. What would you add to that, Josh?
I think I totally agree with that. It is all about the sound, and you know, I can take poor quality for a good performance over good quality for a mediocre or poor performance any day, any day. And, you know, again, like Dale said, we nowadays everything is so hi-fi and we have, you know, these demands almost, you know, but and the garage rock and the punk rock stuff that I work with a lot of the time, you know, people are going backwards, you know, and getting some of that dirt back. And it's a lot of fun. And like, well, I'll do certain bands on 2-inch tape still, because that's what we're trying to go for. Instead of trying to make some digitized process of it, let's just do it that way. Do it live, you know. But when the band comes to me that wants to do it that way, I make them go to the studio, the rehearsal room, for a heavy amount of time and get a lot of practice done, because to do it that way, you got to be really well rehearsed and everybody needs to know their songs. I always tell them, if you can't play your song forward and backwards by yourself without anybody else, we're not ready to do this the way that you want it to be done, because otherwise it's just work for all of us and no one has the time to do to make it right at the end. If I got to spend 30 hours of editing, what's the point of doing it that way? I'd rather just spend a full day of just doing it.
Only takes 3 minutes to re-record the
song. You know what I mean? It's just like, what's
but it should stand up. You should be able to put a boombox in your recording space and have a song that sounds like all the elements are there, and then you're ready to bring it to the studio. But there's definitely a lot of, because we can fix everything and our ears are so tuned to this perfection now, there is a lot of that going on. And I enjoy actually making stuff the absolute best it can possibly sound. And I really enjoy that. But I know there's a fine line. I pretend like the ability to tune notes doesn't exist when I'm tracking an artist. I don't bring it up. We don't talk about it. And then we get the best performances. And then we decide. And if you go back and listen to stuff from the 70s, you will be blown away. If you put on your little producer's cap 2017 and listen back, you'll be like, darn, man, Karen Carpenter is so out of tune there. But I love those songs. They're pop smash hits. And that's why you hear a lot of doubled vocals, to get around those things.
That was the thing,
And then to fix a lot of the problems that we can now fix digitally, they would do tricks that actually became the modern production values that we have. Like they would put slap back, kind of a quick delay on rockabilly stuff. The guy's out of tune, it kind of adds a a thickening agent and fixes it and adds a character. And then that became like, if I were to record Rockabilly today, actually I'm doing an album with Creedence Cattle right now. We put the same effects on there and that defines the sound. But some of these tricks were made as band-aids originally. It's kind of, it's a funny little world of production we live in.
Well, let's pivot a little bit or continue on that vein of the differencing technology versus the analog day to the digital day. And I'll go back to the James Chatto interview. He talked about gain structure. And that used to be a really, really big deal when you were analog and you were running chords here and there and you might have gone into this preamp to this amp to the, you know, this other thing. But to give you an example of my little setup with the ME66, I got my Beach Tech, but I've got the line into my recorder up as high as I possibly can. But the real thing that I found, like digging into this whole gain structure thing, is the reality of they're saying is that's less and less vital because of the whole digital realm of recording. What would you say?
Yes and no. Okay, right. And I went through this with a lot of people. So if you had a cassette player, you're old enough to have had a cassette player, to learn how loud you could drive that record you're recording onto the cassette before it didn't sound good. Some cassette players could go way into the red. Some could not. The meters were set by the factory at what they thought would be best for the user. Even my first digital recorders, I didn't learn for about 6 years that the red was actually 2 decibels below the actual red because they wanted to provide a warning track. As a pro, I want red to actually be when I've screwed it up. So you had to learn when, and certain tracks could hit the red, like something with a big transient attack, like a snare drum. But certain things, like a singer, if it went red, you ruined it. It just was crunchy and terrible. And it took a long time, probably took 10 years into digital for me to really wrap my head around, for a lot of different reasons, you need to do the same thing, which is try and get the loudest level to tracks. Mm-hmm. Because it's not for hiss, it's that you need the maximum amount of bits. You want the signal using the most bits possible. And so if you're recording only half the level, say you have 100 dB and you're recording 50 dB low, you're only recording at 12-bit or 16-bit. So what you're doing is you're creating a pixelated version of the audio, and then when you turn it up, that pixelation's in there. It's very slight, but it's a perceived thing, and the best engineers are sweating over getting the level as hot as they can. Now we're going, it's much less of a big deal with 24-bit than it was with 16-bit, and we're going to 32-bit. It's going to be less of a big deal, but it's still a big deal for a while until we switch to another type of digital recording I won't get into. Yeah, so you really have to pay attention. I remember people being dismissive about that in the digital days. Well, I only need to record this low, but I want extra room. Mm-hmm. No, you don't. You want your multitrack really hot and banging. Get a hot signal passing through all the gear, sounds better, and then you can bring it down if you want to do it. So that's how I feel.
Just looking at my Beach Tech, when you look at the owner's manual for it, it's a two-channel Beach Tech XLR. They tell you, put the gain as high as you possibly can. So I'm on 10, and then you go back in and you make sure it looks good on your recording. And then if you have to do anything, you back off, but you never want to be, you know, turning it up to 11.
And and so the better signal noise ratio you have, the more smooth all your processing that you're going to do after the fact will operate. You'll have less of what we used to call pumping, where hiss comes in and out as you compress and things like that. So for a lot of different reasons, you still need to record loud.
I totally agree with that. And I used to, early on be afraid of clipping, and I'm still, we don't want to clip, but getting that signal as loud and as hot as you can is definitely, don't be afraid of it. We need it. I go backwards because I didn't grow up with the tape machines. The most tape machine stuff that I did in the studio was splicing leader on record tones, but I definitely wasn't like chopping chords. So it wasn't a regular thing. So now it's a privilege and something fun that I get to do. And so with that, it's funny because the noise is what we're going for, is to make it noisy, kind of, and kind of mess it up. We're not trying to get there's no Dolby. There's no nothing on our tracks. I like things hot. I came up with that for me, when I came up with what I started leaning towards and what I was appreciating, which is, preamps on the verge, not distortion. Well, there's good distortion and there's bad distortion, right? And I find that there's a nice threshold on certain preamps and, learning those and what can drive just enough to make it gritty, but not bad distortion.
There can be very musical distortion if it's a tube thing, depending on where you're distorting it in the chain of devices.
And some of
can
the
be very rock musical, and again, can be iconic. Mm-hmm. you know, Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, totally.
Distorted. Yeah. But that became the sound, and that probably happened by accident. Same with Sam Cooke, you know, and they're like, that's the take, you know, we're going to go with that. But tubes overdriving are super cool sounding, and solid state is sort of cool sounding, and digital clipping is...
not that awesome.
Not good sounding. Not that awesome unless you're really going for something super weird.
I mean, super weird.
Shout out to Tony Delgado. Maybe I'll splice it in. He's a tube geek. I interviewed a guy that's a tube geek.
Oh, cool.
He builds his own amps, repurposes tubes, and he talked about just that very same thing.
Even harmonics. Woo!
Even harmonics.
Yeah. You almost looked a little like him. He's kind of like that. So what's the process look like for a band or a solo artist thinking about spending the dough for a professional recording session?
I always work with any budget, no matter what. You tell me what we need, what we have, and we'll find a facility, a way to do it, and to get it all finished the way that you need to. It's not it's preparation, really, for me. I mean, that's all. I want to make sure that we're all going in knowing exactly what's going to happen, because if we don't have enough time to do it, so many things come up, I think, that you can, you know, you can semi-prepare for, but, you know, what happens when... a microphone breaks or something, and that was going to be the microphone that you were going to use. It doesn't happen often, but, you know, just...
That's kind of an interesting concept, because a lot of people are trained that if the first thing the person says is, how much do you have to spend, that they might be trying to rip you off. But in the sound, you absolutely kind of got to need to know, what's your budget? Film's the same way.
Yeah, exactly. You can, obviously spend, and I do a lot of the back work at home, all the editing and stuff at home, so it doesn't cost, we don't need a facility to do that. And I still think a song a day, is kind of the if you think about it, when you break it all down, when I've done records for a couple of weeks and we're tracking a full length, 14, 15 songs or whatever, still comes down to about a song a day. Whether we tracked all the drums in the first 2 days or whatever, when it all stretches out, it's like, oh, we could have just done that. When I'm doing full lengths and we have the budget, that kind of thing, I'm like, spend a week, we'll do one or two songs a day, and we'll just get a lot of comfortable work done, Then that's, I get back to the comfortability of it. When I got someone playing like, okay, bass player's got to be gone at 6 for work. We have 3 more tracks to do. And everyone starts looking at the clock and you just hear it. You start hearing, and then they get frustrated or mess up more because, okay, well, shit, I got to go. Oh. But,
But sometimes I get 70% of the good takes in the last 30% of the session because... yeah. Everybody's warmed up. They're comfortable. Maybe they've taken a few breaks. They know how it sounds. They're not putting on headphones and trying to play is a somewhat of a foreign experience to people. They haven't done it a few times. So sometimes you get good stuff towards the end. But that is, knowing that there's no back end. If they want to continue and do one more, then we do one more. I never cut it short. I try to be like Survivor in the studio, and I want to outlast the band. I don't want to call a session because I'm tired. They've got it. Another one in them, we're going to do it. But absolutely, preparation. The way people use studios, as I mentioned in the introduction, has changed. So a lot of people will come in and use the studio for its strengths, like it's the sonic quality of the room, the sonic quality of the microphones, the preamps, the converters. And one example would be Maddie Grover's been recording with me, and then she takes the tracks home. So she records the drums and the guitars and the vocals here, and then she'll usually go home and record the bass because that takes her longer to work out. And they quickly, after recording drums in their garage for a while, their dad, Gino, Maddie's dad, actually convinced them, hey, come up to the studio and hear it. And after that, they cut every track because they could hear the difference. So in 2 hours, an hour sometimes, she can cut a whole song, which she needs because they're very prepared. And then she just takes the stuff home on a thumb drive and then works on it. Other people come in and have me do editing that they can't do at home. So there's a lot more back and forth. I mean, we're talking about how we even mix at home. I'm building a mix spot in my house, and right now doing most of the mixing in my old control room back from the 90s right now. And it's nice to be able to work on sessions over a period of time and listen to a mix, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, make a few more tweaks. But I was doing an album for the Ford brothers that we recorded at Sierra Nevada Brewery, and Pat Ford was at the studio, and he told me, it seems to take about the same amount of time, even though we're in digital now as analog, it seems like the whole process really nets out about the same amount of hours. And that seems to be true. And I've heard that, you know, Luddites and different people talking about the efficiency of modern technology. It's the time savings is 1%, 5%. The amount of time it takes sort of expands into to the budget that's there. And if we work as fast as possible, then if there's a little more budget, maybe we'll go for that extra vocal thing or that extra thing. So it kind of expands into the time. So working smart in the studio is a good way to do it. I have plenty of clients, though, who have had home setups, are frustrated by it, and just want to be pampered and treated to a really wonderful experience where they only have to make musical decisions about their creation. They don't have to make the technical decisions, and they love that. Like, I've had people plop on the couch like with this feeling of relief, like, wow, I can just say, hey, I want a little more snowflake on that thing, and you'll do it. People really enjoy and appreciate that depending on where they are financially. But yeah, most albums cost a lot less to make than most people imagine they cost to make.
It really is true. It's like, yeah, we have a wonderful facility here, but you know, this, it's not as expensive as you think it is to make a really great record at all.
I'll go back to what Dale had said earlier. And with the first segment I did was Scott Grist. He just had an 8-track Tascam. He got it at a pawn shop for $150, and he said, all I got is this 8-track Tascam I bought for $150 with the built-in mics. What can I do with it? And he put together some really nice tracks for himself and some of his friends. And it was just really cool because that made his decision. This is what I got. This is how I'm going to record it. Yeah.
That's a lot of what I do with bands when we talk about making a record is, you know, I usually we go have coffee or a beer or food, or, you know, and we all talk about what records we like. We talk about music and what we're trying to do. And so, you know, that automatically, okay, cool, we're going to make a metal record, we're going to make a reggae record, we're going to make a folk record. These are all very different ways to make a record. You cannot, there's no stamp that does records, you know, in my opinion. Like, I don't have one way of working. Mm-hmm.
Even though you can make all those records with the same microphones and the same computer. but what you get is a completely different result by having a different approach and
learning the approach.
And learning the approach.
You know, what needs to happen for, you know, I've done, you know, a band from Santa Cruz, and it was an 11-piece soul band, The Insiders, and how to approach that in a studio that usually does one track at a time. Mm-hmm. That's usually how they work. And so I was like, not them specifically, but this studio. And we made it work. I was like, all right, well, we're going to do it different.
James Chatto actually used a beautiful metaphor. He did a shout out for a CSUC professor, but he said, microphones are like paintbrushes.
Exactly.
Maybe you guys could pick that one up. Microphones are like paintbrushes.
They are. They all have a different sonic flavor. And so that's the first place to start picking the sound that you want to go for. And it's not just the mic, it's how the mic is placed. And there's some great engineers that can get away with very minimal processing on the back end by just getting that placement. We're in a microphone renaissance. There's a ton of really good microphones now for not that much money. Mm-hmm. And I think it leans back to what you're saying about Scott having that $150 recorder. You do not want to wait to record your masterpiece till you feel like you have bought all the perfect gear to do it, because you'll just keep chasing your tail. And so that's why, you know, people always beat up on the Shure SM57, the most popular dynamic microphone of all time. But
my Desert Island mic.
I tell them the SM57 puts food on the table for me. I mean, it's a microphone that gets the job done, works in a lot of applications. It's not a substitute for other amazing Neumann mics or whatever, but a good engineer could put all 57s up and get a great recording. So it's about the placement of the mics. And then it goes into some other things on the front end that really start to separate the bigger players from the other players, which would be the microphone preamp, which we use all Class A mic pre's, which are basically the design that is used in, say, a $50,000 or $100,000 console. So that's the mic preamp. And what that does is
That's the paint to me.
Yeah, it allows the microphone to work more uninhibited than if it was run through, say, a crummy $1,000 mixer. So that adds a lot to it. And then the conversion to digital is also another thing that adds very slightly to the quality, but does make a difference across all the tracks. So
my $100 Studio Master and a 57 can do something funny. It does a thing, you know? It could work for that one thing, but yeah. Yeah. You know what, Dale? We should try that. We should do a guinea pig experiment. Just only we can only use 57s.
I wanted to actually go into like this is one of my things.
And that's your studio number here. It's 57. Oh, yeah.
I thought a double blind test to do at one of the colleges where you have a singer behind a thing, a scrim, and you have the students, and you tell them that you're trying a bunch of different mics, but you really just have an SM57 up, and then you use different microphone pre's. Yeah. And I guarantee you would fake almost everybody out
because
the different quality you get from the tube pre versus the Neve, just the 1973
sound. API to a
they
Mackie.
All have a different thing. So all these things color the sound in a way that we're thinking about on the way in to sort of make our sound. And again, the mics and the mic pre's have a tradition that it's good to know what the production tradition is, and then therefore you can violate it in different ways to get the sound that you want or get the traditional sound or break the rules.
I always tell them, you know the rules before you can break the rules when it comes to that kind of stuff. Because, yes, artistry, and I do consider this a lot of, you know, making art, and so there aren't any rules per se, but there's some things you probably shouldn't do if you want to get the end result.
Well, if you've read the Dan Levitin's "This Is Your Brain on Music," there are rules for genres, just like there are rules for a triangle, right? We all know what a triangle is; it has three sides, but we can look at many different objects and say that's a triangle. And so, the same thing would be for music that you grew up with and particularly gravitated to as your brain was developing teenage years is what you understand the rules best. Mm-hmm. So let's take rock and roll, right? I listen to a lot of Led Zeppelin and every rock band from 1965 to 1980. I was really into that. And I understand the rules of Led Zeppelin, but I also understand when they come out with the song like Tangerine that has mandolin and acoustic and no drums and a pedal steel guitar, that is still rock and roll, but they violated the rules in a certain way that is artistically enjoyable to their listening group. So you know the rules, and then how you violate the rules makes the art. And so that is not only in the style of music, but also in the production aspects of the music. We're thinking about that stuff. We're thinking about all the stuff when we're making your record. You might not even know that. You just get to sit on the couch and hang out and have a beverage and tell us what you like.
We put together, it was really fun. We had Mark Lohr, he's up in Portland now, he used to be in Chico, and I had my next door neighbor. We had 13 years in between us, right? And we actually said what you just said in a different way, Dale. We're like, we all picked a style of heavy metal that fit our teenage years.
Cool, yeah.
We all picked. Of course, the Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, you know, so kind of thing.
Metallica.
Yeah. It all fits back to your age.
And as an engineer, I think both Josh and I have a super broad appreciation of all kinds of music.
I like all kinds.
I mean, I've recorded Swiss polka bands. I've recorded giant Mexican groups, you know, electric groups that play at like Feather Falls. I've recorded you know, jug bands and rock bands and metal bands and new age bands and understanding the different styles. That's what keeps me interested. I have a voracious musical appetite. And so one example would be I listened to a lot of reggae music in college. Like most people, right? They get Legend. It's like the dorm room 101 reggae album. And I loved it. And then I worked at KCSE and I had a reggae show. I knew a lot about reggae as a listener and an enjoyer, but then I had never musically broken down how that music is put together as a player. And so then I took it upon myself to join a band and play reggae and try to figure it out. And when I joined the band, I knew nothing about how to play it. And so it started a new journey on that music. And then you learn how the production quality works. And I mastered that style. And I was growing up in the Bay Area. And I graduated in 84. I was actually with my 4-track recorder recording a lot of early rappers that went to my high school.
Cool.
We still had the desegregation thing. And so we had a really mixed high school. And I would go to East Palo Alto with my 4-track and record these guys with their TR-909s and hip-a-de-hop, you know, and remember when the pacing of rap was that speed. But I learned the style really early on, had an appreciation. And so while a lot of musicians I meant record are more locked into two or three genres that they really like, I like them all. And it's kind of funny, sometimes I'll hear derogatory comments about this style of music or that style. And I just necessarily set people straight. I just kind of bite my tongue and get on with what the task is. But I really love all styles of music. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy to me too. You know, my iPod playlist is gonna be, it's gonna be pretty interesting. The morning listen can go from classical to Slayer to just all over the board. Kid, well, because I got my beautiful 4-year-old daughter, so we listen to kids' songs and that kind of stuff she loves. And
are you just, Rafi or
no? You know what, she's into Sheb, the Purple People Eater. That's her deal right
oh,
now.
Oh yeah,
that's her jam.
We were really, you know, my kids are in their late 20s now, but
she loves Rafi though. She does.
VeggieTales.
VeggieTales
was badass.
Yeah, VeggieTales.
Yeah. I don't know what the latest stuff is people are subjected to, but the best kids' music is actually written with a lot of intellect and designed for both parents and children to get something out of it.
Totally.
Barney doesn't quite hit the mark.
No.
No, they're
talking down to everybody.
That would be the anti.
So what advice you got? We'll start with you, Josh, for sound geeks thinking of getting into a sound engineering career or even a recording live music career.
And just get out there and do it, you know? Yeah. Like I said, get the 4-track, get something that you can afford that makes it, and learn every aspect of that little piece of gear. And you'd be surprised at how much you can. You don't need the Neumann and the Neve, you know, to do anything good. There's no, that's not a necessity, you know, and just getting the principles right and going, you know, for live sound is like, well, that's how I made my rent, you know, when I was learning how to, you know, being an intern, because you couldn't really do too much other stuff. So I just went to clubs, you know. Sometimes I'd fit my way of what my experience was in the early days, you know, just to get the job. But then if you, you know, understood it well enough, you know, and you got the job done, the band was happy and the club owner was happy, and then, all right, you win. Definitely, you know, but you get out there and just do as much as you can and learn about it. There's so much information available nowadays, you know, and I was just talking to Alex this morning about that. It's just like, you know, everyone can get a YouTube thing up and learn how this is done, you know, but try it and try some other YouTube versions of that principle and see which one works the way that you like to work. I think, you know, I think that there's so many ways to skin a cat, as they say. But I think the experience of the individual and knowing your gear in and out, whatever it is the most important thing.
Yeah, if you have one piece of gear and you learn it really well, that's better than winning the lottery and buying a whole recording studio, because you'll never learn any piece of gear that well. When you have to just one thing to work with, you learn it very well, how it works, what the rules are, how to break the rules. But getting back to the question, I try to do a little audio every day. Jerry Seinfeld says, if you want to do comedy, you do comedy every day. And so I do a little audio thing every day. It might be posting a YouTube clip, doing a little video, audio for video, do a little something. And, you know, probably drives my wife crazy, but I'll be with the laptop editing something, you know, in bed or whatever. Try to do something, maybe read some articles if you're not recording that day. And go online and look at some tutorials, but do something every day towards your goal. 80% of success is showing up. I mean, show up when you say you're going to show up and do what you say you're going to do. Be ready to stand by, because sometimes your boss is overwhelmed with an idea and you don't have anything to do at that moment, but you're going to have something to do as soon as he figures out what is going on. I had a great intern that now is on a national tour with Tribal Seeds and some of those guys, and he was always standing by. If he saw me go into the back of a rack, he turned the light on his phone and gave me a flashlight. He was just ready to give me stuff. And just stay enthusiastic. There's a lot of really tedious things people don't know. I'm working on an archival project with a guy, and it's about 160 songs, and he needed screenshots of every single folder that had a Pro Tools session. I went home yesterday and I cut 67 screen grabs into 67 PDFs and Dropbox to him so he could sort out what's going on. So there's a lot of really tedious, like, what am I doing this for moments. I mean, that was so many mouse clicks, I was going crazy. But that's what I needed to move that music forward at that time, was this very clerical, mundane process. And you'll run into those things, and you have to do that to get to the cream.
I understand to me that this bottom line, a lot of it that, you know, early on, you know, when I was assisting and stuff, is what the producer told me was the bottom line is it's a customer service. You know, someone came to you to get something, and so you give them what they need or want, and then from there you both can collaborate of what should be done. And maybe here's an, yeah, if you want to try that, we can do this. We've, you know, in my experience, this doesn't work, or vice versa. And so a lot of times people are like, no, we've done this before. And I'm like, I don't know. And it works. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. Yeah, you know, develop new ways to do stuff. Or
absolutely. I run into sessions. I have a session I'm mixing right now where the engineer they tracked with, did the recording with, every time they had an idea, he came forward with a reason why the idea wasn't going to work. And what I've learned is it's a growing learning process for everybody. So as engineers, we try to predict what's going to happen in our head. But if I suggest an idea and the band doesn't want that idea, then I drop it and move forward with their idea. If they ask my opinion at any given moment, I have an opinion about what's there, but I'm not constantly pounding my opinion over their head because I want their music to be their creation and sound like what they want it to be. And if we try that idea and it doesn't work, they learn something.
Yeah.
If we try the idea and it does work, then I learned something.
Yeah, exactly.
I came up with a quote I really use all the time, Dale. I say, the most important thing about advice is how you react when it's not taken.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah,
that's it. I'm telling you. I use that every day, dude. I swear.
Nearly.
Yeah, yeah. No copyright intended. You know, it's really been fun. You know, we're talking with Josh Garcia and Dale Price here at their studios, number 57 down here in the Gasoline Alley. The new name is Electric Plant. Before closing comments, I mean, how do we get a hold of Josh Garcia if we're like, oh my God, I love what I'm hearing. How can I record with Josh Garcia? How do they get a hold of you, man?
Josh Garcia Recording at Gmail or jgaudioproductions.com. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can still go to the electriccanyon.com website, which is sort of the world of my engineering world, all the different aspects of it. And all my contact information is on there. And then I can also put you in contact with Josh through there if needed.
Yeah.
If you guys got anything out there now for this brand new emerging seed called Electric Plant?
As far as...
like a website or, I mean...
We're working on it. Yeah, the original Electric Energy Plant site is still up and we're kind of figuring out how to put all that together. There will be a Facebook page.
Yeah, there's start of a Facebook page happening, and we're just, you know, the time. Yeah. We're all so busy. It's just trying to, we're working on it, though.
We have a lot of lists going
there's
on
a lot
right
of
now.
Lists.
But the most important thing is we've got
we're
the
working.
Facility working, yeah, and sounding great, mm-hmm. and people are reporting that they're very comfortable recording here, and so that, to me, is one of the most important things.
And being able to work so many different ways, because we have a lot, me and Dale are very, very, you know, similar, but very, we also can work differently, you know, and
yeah.
everybody can be happy here. And mm-hmm. it's
so, yeah, we've built a studio to either of us, any engineer can walk in and do it their way. The old place, because I was my own private Idaho, I kind of had my workflow set up and kind of hardwired in a way that worked for me. But here it's more open architecture, thanks to Josh's experience working in some top-notch studios in the Bay Area, saying this is how it ought to go down. So
I have to slip this question in because I actually, the first time I read about you coming down from the canyon down into the Chico, what you were talking about, they were talking about a mobile recording studio, but earlier on we were talking about, you know, using the tools that you have in front of you, but I wrote Machine Head, man, the Rolling Stones mobile, you know, and they did that whole album in like 2 weeks or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Are you still moving forward with your mobile?
I do mobile recording for PBS occasionally and for different artists. Sometimes it shows. Not as much as I used to. I did just put a new style. I have a pretty massive solar and battery setup in the van, and I have what's called a pure sine wave inverter so I can run audio equipment in there and record. And I'm actually looking forward to doing some really cool recording just out in nature, far from any plugs.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But I still actually... I've been doing some mobile recording in Red Bluff with an artist who has an amazing piano. So a lot of times if there's a thing like a piano that we can't,
that's good to know.
We have a nice piano here, but you know, if somebody wants to go record an excellent piano at another place, and we know of several, I'm sure many of our artists can guess, we can go to that place and record the piano or record a live show. So yeah, I do a fair amount of mobile. Probably the most mobile recording I've done in the last 8 years has been for Paradise Symphony. I do 4 albums a year for them. And we cut it down to 1 this year, but I think it's 32 different classical recordings of their concerts where I bring the truck in, bring all the mic pre's, basically disassemble the nuts and bolts of the studio to get that kind of recording in a mobile environment. And it's a lot of fun.
Closing comments, starting with you, Josh.
I'm just really stoked to be up here and, you know, recording up. And like I said, I've been going back and forth for a bit now, and it's just nice to have a what I call a real facility to work out of. And it's been meeting Dale and working with Dale more and more. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm just really stoked to be up here and be a part of the music scene up here. It's a great scene.
Yeah, and we're stoked to have Josh here, and it's exciting to have it. Another engineer that I can collaborate with on a level that, you know, we're working on a professional level, both live and stuff. Like I said, we have a lot of common artists we've worked with and a lot of friends up here that are common, and it's just great to do more collaboration and share a space with other engineers. And I think the end result is it's going to make all the recordings that come out of here, no matter who does the recording, Joe Levine or Josh or myself or Bo, really sound fantastic. And so that's one of the neat things about moving out of the canyon is everyone that comes through here will benefit from that higher quality. And so I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really excited about, I put 25,000 miles on my motorcycle commuting back and forth because I haven't lived up there for 10 years. And you give it your all in a session, then you drive home and you have to dodge deer and, you know, fires and all these things. You know, keeping a place going out in the woods is a lot of work. That's why Richard Branson closed his first studio after he recorded Michael Oldfield Tubular Bells. He couldn't keep the country estate going. And so I kind of felt like that, where I was overwhelmed. I was actually touring a lot the last year and a half. I hung that up to really start focusing on this place again. It's just a lot of work. And so I know it came as a surprise to a lot of people, but it's everybody that's been at the old place and been at the new place has been pretty stoked on the new thing that's going on. So we're excited about it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Guillermo.